21-3268 Andrew Rice et al. Versus the Village of Johnstown, Ohio. Oral argument, 15 minutes per side. Mr. Zeiger for the appellant.
Thank you. May it please the court, Your Honor, opposing counsel. The district court granted Johnstown's summary judgment motion, finding that appellants lacked standing because the property at issue is contiguous to Johnstown, but has not been annexed into Johnstown. Well, annexation here is little more than a red herring. The constitutional violation, the final standardless decision by an unelected P&Z commission, occurred prior to the denial of the annexation petition. So after the fact, decisions on annexation are not relevant here.
Mr. Zeiger, I mean, this is really a question for both of you, but out of curiosity, is an annexation petition a one and done situation? So let's say hypothetically, let's just put this case to the side. Hypothetically, you start at ground zero, you put the constitutional arguments to the side, you bring a new PUD rezoning application, and like manna from heaven, you get it. At that point, does the local law allow you to try again on annexation?
It does, Your Honor. And in fact, we've submitted two annexation petitions already. Uh-huh. So you're allowed to submit as many as you would like. It's not res judicata. And also, Your Honor, the annexation we know is not a precondition to the consideration of the PUD application because we know what Johnstown did here.
Can I ask another question?
Of course, Your Honor.
Judge Morrison seemed to be thinking about a little bit. I mean, it is a little unusual to have a case where you're challenging something that happened, your client's challenging something that happened in a different jurisdiction. Now, I get the point that, of course, an annexation motion, that's the whole point. It's going to come from someone outside that jurisdiction. But are there limits on that? I mean, for example, if I had property in Indiana and I petitioned Johnstown both for annexing the property from Indiana and then rezoning it for this development, would someone just look at the regulations and say, well, that's laugh out loud silly. You can only annex if it's proximate, adjacent, and it can't be if it's in another state or separated by other counties? Or are there any limits at all on that?
I do believe that there are limits, and here the limits would not apply given the fact that this is a contiguous property.
And is that the limit? Is the limit a contiguous point?
You know, Your Honor, it is not a contiguous point, but it also is the way that Johnstown has elected to structure their regulations. Because here they allow you to not have to submit for the annexation first before you put in your rezoning application. Here, what they did was they took our $26,000 filing fee. They accepted the application. They ran us through their process and they voted on the rezoning prior to addressing the annexation petition altogether. So we know from their own actions that nothing precluded Johnstown from approving the preliminary plan without annexation already done. And actually, we expected and still expect annexation to be forthcoming. And so far as your point, Judge, about the fact that it's not one and done. Number two, the fact that Johnstown represented, as you'll see in Mr. Wilcox's affidavit, that the annexation was a mere formality. And number three, the Ohio Supreme Court's case law that states that you give the property owners the freedom of choice in annexation decisions. So here,
can I back you up for 1 minute? Where will I find a statement that annexation was a mere formality? Whose affidavit says that?
That's Mr. Jonathan Wilcox's affidavit and 30-.
Oh, so that's the developer that you are working with. And so in his experience, he thinks that once you got the commission's approval and the village's approval on your PUD, annexation would follow.
His
that's a witness on your side, not on their side.
There's a witness on my side, but he's recounting conversations that he had with Johnstown throughout the 18 months that they were trying to develop this.
Is Johnstown the ultimate authority on the annexation? Does anybody else have any part to play in this?
Your Honor, that's a great question. The county does. The county does. And in fact, it starts with Johnstown. Johnstown issues services resolutions saying that they can provide the capacity necessary. Then it goes to the county. Johnstown didn't object to either of those steps, but then it came back to Johnstown for the final decision. So what we know is that the case law and the representations made by Johnstown related to annexation show that annexation should still occur, but all of those annexation issues were on a post-constitutional violation timeline, and therefore, in our view, is not an issue on appeal.
Were there any other representations or denial of representations made by Johnstown?
Johnstown has already always taken the position that the ultimate rezoning would be contingent upon being annexed in, but they have not made any representations to my knowledge about the preliminary plan approval, which was what was denied and was the constitutional violation here. And the reason
that leads me to my next question, which has really been bothering me about this whole thing, which is exactly what is the legally protected interest that you claim has been injured here?
Your Honor, Judge Graham has a decision in the Powell case that follows the Roberge case and the Eubank case, which says that an unlawful delegation of legislative authority to an unelected commission without discernible standards is a violation of due process.
Wouldn't any zoning commission in most cities and villages and townships, the zoning commissions aren't elected? So are you saying then that all zoning commissions, that in any of the deliberations and decisions that they come down with are subject to constitutional objection because they're not elected?
No, Your Honor. What we're saying is that a legislative body like the council should be able to delegate some of those powers to a P&Z commission, but they have to do it with discernible standards here. And that's what
standards in how they delegate the power, standards in how they appoint the commission, standards in how they delegate the power, or standards in how the commission operates.
Applies the power, Judge. You can't have vague standards like they did here, which talk about the general welfare. You got to do things in the general welfare of the community. It has to reflect the legislative will, which is what Judge Graham found in the Powell decision when he said you don't have to have a procedural or substantive due process claim. You can have this delegation of authority claim, but it has to be related to the fact that there aren't discernible standards that are given to unelected people. And that's what happened here. The unelected folks made the final decision, which denied the ability to get to the legislative body that's supposed to be making these decisions.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that in the Roberge and the Eubanks cases, you had a situation where the zoning authority, the people who were making the decision, actually were private individuals who had their own interests. Is that not the case?
That is the case, Your Honor. In those cases, it had to do with having some legislative authority provided to private individuals. Here, that's exactly what happened, is that it goes to the private individuals that are appointed on the P&Z. So you don't have
what kind of zoning commissions? What kind of zoning commissions don't comprise private individuals who get appointed to do this work?
Usually that is what happens, but usually they have discernible standards that they need to apply. And here they didn't, which has caused injury to our client by having to go through this process only to get to the end where they find out they get denied with no ability to get to the person that should be the ultimate decision maker.
You're indicating that the whether those zoning officials, appointed officials, have actual private interests of their own is not important here.
Your Honor, I don't think that it is important related to the private interests of the folks on the P&Z Commission. I think that it's important that they have discernible standards to apply when they are applying what the legislative body has delegated. And here they undisputedly did not do that. And that created hundreds of thousands of dollars of damages. And that action alone was traceable to the conduct of the P&Z Commission and ultimately winds up with damages that my client has sustained, which frankly can be redressed on both compensatory damages, nominal damages, as the U.S. Supreme Court has recently found in 2021, as well as putting us back in to the process, because Johnstown admitted we checked all the boxes on the application for getting the approval of the preliminary plan, as well as the final plan, only under the old regime, had to actually comply with the preliminary plan. So we have every expectation that putting us back into the system will get us to where we need to be in terms of getting this approved by the legislative body.
Okay, so Mr. Sager, your time's up, but let me make sure my colleagues don't have any other questions at this point. Okay, so you'll get your full rebuttal. Thank you very much. Mr. Schauer, you have your, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Yaz Ashrawi. I'm here on behalf of the appellee, the Village of Johnstown, Ohio. The appellants in this case lack standing to raise their due process claims and alternatively with their due process claims would fail on the merits.
So primarily, counsel, can I start you out? You know, one thing that I do appreciate about your position is that this is an unusual constitutional theory. There are not a lot of these cases. It's hard to find one exactly like this one. But it often happens in standing cases that people have this instinct to merge the standing inquiry with the merits inquiry. And so if we just try to throw the merits one to the side, and that's what the point of this hypothetical is. So assume everything in my hypothetical is exactly the same. It's the exact system. It's the same counties. Everything's the same. There's only one difference. The problem isn't that the commission doesn't have discernible standards to implement. The problem is that the commission has decided to grant applications for people of one faith, but not from people of other faiths. So everything else is the same. And so they just have a faith-based rule. So they didn't appeal the annexation ruling. They only appealed the rezoning ruling. So everything else is the same. Wouldn't we say there's standing to get to the merits in that case?
There may be standing under an equal protection argument, Your Honor, but not on due process.
Well, how is that?
As this court has held,
Let me just start. One of your arguments and one of Judge Morrison's points was they didn't appeal the annexation.
That's correct.
That's true in my hypothetical. In my hypothetical, the annexation is not appealed. Why do they get their equal protection claim? Why is there standing for their equal protection claim then, but not in your case?
Because under the equal protection clause, you have the right to be free from unequal treatment under the law. And so if you have a comparator, you have another entity that's being treated differently based on things that are protected in the due process.
In their case, arena, you have a right. If their claim, we're assuming good merits, right? You have to, and you're doing the standing inquiry, unless it's just a bozo bonkers claim, you have to assume there's merit. So their claim is that there aren't discernible standards. I don't understand why one constitutional claim has standing, injury in fact, redressability, you name it, and the other doesn't. That just doesn't make sense to me.
Well, let me answer it a different way then, Your Honor. If we're assuming in both the hypothetical and the case here that neither situation, the annexation was not challenged. I think in both instances, there wouldn't be standing because there'd be a redressability issue. And your opinion in the Midwest property.
Okay, so let's stick with that. You bring your application. They say, no, you don't get it because you're of the wrong faith. We only allow these rezoning applications for people of a different faith. You challenge that and you don't challenge the annexation ruling. As I understand it, the annexation rules aren't one and done. You're allowed to bring a later one if suddenly the rezoning's approved. So why wouldn't that be redressable?
Because the rezoning, and let me back up. I agree with my colleague on the other side that the denial of the annexation is a red herring. It's not the fact that the annexation was denied. It's the fact that the property has never been in the village to begin with. So at the time of the denial.
How do you bring an annexation motion if you're not outside the village? That's the whole point.
Well, right. And typically one would bring an annexation petition first and foremost before incurring or taking on the process to rezone and develop the property, because without being in the village, you do not have the rights to those zoning codes or that process. In fact, there was testimony at the hearing from the village manager that is cited in our reply in motion for summary judgment document 32 that states there's been a lot of questions about annexations in this process. Council still is the final decision maker on whether this entire project goes through. We're not going to approve the zoning for a property in Monroe Township. That's not going to happen. This only becomes real if the annexation goes through in the future. The annexation did not go through, and that is an alternate bar on this development. And at the end of the day, the injury that
Judge Larson has a question.
So maybe I misunderstand, but is it your position that annexation has to come first? That annexation is a precondition to the zoning approval?
It is, Your Honor, because the village does not have zoning authority over a piece of property not in the village. So in this instance, for example, any decision would have been contingent, would have been hypothetical, and subject to the annexation. There would have been a decision made. It would have had no effect, however, unless and until the annexation, for example, an approval would have had no effect unless and until an annexation was thereafter approved.
Sure, but they could have approved it. So let me see if I understand. The P&Z Commission could have approved the zoning, and yes, then the Village Council could have approved the zoning, and then the annexation could have taken place, and then the whole thing would have effect. So you could.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You can go step one, zoning, step two, annexation. But what happened, so you're not saying annexation must come first. This other process, step one could have come first. Zoning.
Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor. In an ideal world, annexation would come first. But in this instance, the developer wanted to pursue simultaneous applications. The problem with that.
Have been done before, simultaneous applications?
Not in the Village of Johnstown, no, not in this process. In fact, part of the problem with that is, Your Honor, the annexation laws and the annexation timelines are a bit convoluted and are dictated by the Ohio Revised Code. For example, as Mr. Zeiger stated, the application first goes to the village to pass one particular piece of legislation and then gets sent back to the county. The county spends 60 days with it. It then gets sent back to the village. Then the village has to sit and wait for at least 60 days before it does anything with it. And then between day 60 and day 120, it must act. And if it doesn't, it's rejected.
This is really helpful, but I just want to make sure I'm not misunderstanding something that I thought was in the record. And I thought it was in the record that the claimants were told you can apply at the same time. Is that just wrong, or is there a debate of fact about that?
I don't know whether they were told that. It's certainly true that they could, but it's also equally true that the zoning and the development.
Can I stop you there? I'm not grasping your, you seem to be making a sequencing argument, which is resonating. Like it, that seems like a really powerful point, but then I hear that there isn't a sequencing. So if there's no sequencing rule, why can't they challenge one part of the application process? I guess I'm struggling with that.
Yeah, Your Honor, I apologize if it sounded like I was making a sequencing argument. What I was suggesting is that regardless of the sequence, none of the zoning or development processes and approvals become effective unless there's an annexation, whether the annexation is first or whether it's last.
But how often is it the case? I think you would tell me you never get an annexation when zoning is denied. And I would guess that annexations often, but not always, happen when zoning's approved.
I think that's right, Your Honor.
Okay. So let's just stop there. Back to my faith-based denial. You need both. We got that. It's not very useful to have something rezoned when it's not within the jurisdiction you want. You have a faith-based denial of the zoning application, which precludes you from getting the annexation. It doesn't allow you to take the second shot. How is that not an injury in fact? I just don't get it. I don't understand how that could be an injury in fact.
Your Honor, in the present case, the injury in fact that has been alleged is the denial of the planned unit development, the denial of the rezoning and the approval.
On unconstitutional grounds.
Right. The problem is with redressability. And Your Honor, your decision in the Midwest Properties case is right on point with this. There was a challenge to a sign code, stating that the sign code violated the Constitution. And for that reason, 9 sign application permits were denied. And in that opinion, you wrote that that doesn't matter because there was another barrier, that is another provision that stopped the applicant from eventually receiving that sign permit.
I'm sure that opinion was right. Let me just say that. Number one,
very good, Your Honor.
But number two, let me just say it gives me zero pause. If you have an absolute barrier at step two, you're totally right. There is a redressability problem. I'm not hearing an absolute barrier at step two. I'm hearing quite the opposite, that if you get the zoning approved, the odds are quite high you'll get the annexation. But at all events, I'll just call annexation discretionary. All right, let's just call it, I don't even mind if it's a flipping of the coin. What doesn't seem right to me is you are denying someone in my hypothetical access to that coin flip to get what they want based on a constitutional violation. That's astonishing to me that is not an injury in fact that is redressable. It's true. When you flip the coin, you might not get what you want, right? There's discretion at that step two. It might not work out for you. But I just don't understand why you wouldn't say their claim is they have injury in fact to get to the second step.
If the second step is annexation into the village,
yes.
I want to be very clear. That is not the case because, in fact, this applicant specifically requested annexation after their zoning was denied and was still rejected, because it is not the case that they get to dictate whether they annex into the village or not.
You agreed they can bring another annexation motion if the zoning is approved, i.e. if they stop denying it on unconstitutional grounds.
That's correct. But at the time that this alleged injury occurred, they were not in the village, whether the annexation was pending or not. And since then, this ordinance has been amended. And so any future annexation and any future application for a rezoning or development would go through a different process. But at the end of the day, the denial of the rezoning and the development is not an absolute barrier to their development. They can go develop in the township. No rights have been changed. There's been no protected interest. They do not have a protected interest in process. And this court has said that. Object of that process that is.
That goes to the merits, to whether they have a property interest a property interest protected by the Constitution as opposed to whether they have an injury in fact. Right?
Your Honor,
I might not have a property interest in applying for a government job. But if I applied for the government job and I was told you can't work here because we don't hire women, I would have a claim, right? I have an injury in fact, even if I didn't have a property interest, correct?
Well, you're correct, Your Honor. I may have misspoke, and I want to go to another one of Judge Sutton's very well-written decisions in the Brentley case. It is not the fact that you need to have a protected property interest as part of the standing inquiry, but the injury in fact must be, quote, an invasion of a legally protected interest. In Brentley, there was a blind individual that could not access certain credit union benefits because of alleged ADA violations. In that opinion, Judge Sutton held that because that individual is not eligible to benefit from those credit union benefits, irrespective of the potential or alleged ADA violations, there's no injury in fact because
how are the claimants not eligible to bring a zoning and annexation application? I don't understand where it is that they're not eligible any more than someone of the wrong faith. I don't see it.
Your Honor, if you go back to the Brentley case, it's the benefits that the plaintiff was seeking in that case. The benefit the plaintiffs are seeking in this case is the approval of a rezoning and an approval of a development. The annexation wasn't challenged. The approval of the development and rezoning is not under the village's authority. It can't be. It is under the township's authority. They do not receive the benefits of the village's zoning because under Ohio law, the village only has authority over the property in its jurisdiction. Without having the legal benefits from the village's zoning, the village's zoning code does not apply to this property. It never has.
Right, the zoning code doesn't apply, but the process to apply for new zoning, to apply for this PUD, does apply. Like, they went through the process and they were entitled to apply and go through the process.
Conditional
upon ultimate annexation, whether the ultimate rezoning would be conditioned on annexation.
I agree with most of that, Your Honor, but I would say they were not entitled to apply for it. They chose to, the village allowed them to, because they wanted to bring these issues simultaneously, but they certainly were not entitled to it. And
so counsel, I just want to make sure I'm grasping your point. So let's say what happened here was slightly different. We're just going to go back to my hypothetical to simplify it based on faith-based denials. Okay. It's two applications. They do them simultaneously. You say that's not a problem. And in my hypothetical, they deny both on faith-based grounds. They do the annexation and the rezoning application. They look at them together and they say, well, we just don't do this for people of this faith group. Both denied. Now, you would say that flips your argument because you would say at that point, now you do have injury because both have been denied. Is that right?
I think it would depend on what the stated injury is and if it's redressable. If the injury is the denial of equal protection under the law,
No, it's denial of application for zoning. Everything's the same. They want to rezone. Everything's the same. They want to move into Johnstown. They want to do this PUD. Everything's the same. It's just a different constitutional theory. It just happens to be a stronger one, and which is why I'm using it.
Can I ask Judge Sutton, can I ask a question about your question so that I make sure I'm following all of this? Are you, in your hypo, are you saying that they weren't even permitted to apply or that they didn't get what they wanted through the application process because of the faith-based problem?
They applied. They were permitted to apply. And in both instances, they said no to annexation, no to rezoning because you're the wrong faith group.
And Your Honor, I would go back and say,
and I think counsel, you're going to agree that that has standing. I hope so.
Your Honor, I would, if the injury in that case was the denial of their discretionary zoning, it cannot be redressed by this court because they would not be entitled to that rezoning in a different community if not. A property cannot be.
But I'm not sure they're asking this court, and I'll ask this on rebuttal, but I'm not sure they're saying that we as a court should grant them their zoning. They're asking for a declaratory relief, injunctive relief, and they're asking for damages, including nominal damages. They're not asking us, please rezone them.
Well, their injury that they've stated multiple times in their brief, Your Honor, is the denial of their planned unit development zoning and their development. They've said that.
This is the ship's crossing in the night. They want it judged fairly. That's all that's going on. They want it judged fairly. So put the two hypotheticals together. They want it judged not on faith-based grounds, and they want it judged not without discernible standards. That's all that's going on. That's their claim. They're not entitled to anything. And I would say, even in a world in which you had a 1% chance of what you're getting, you got injury in fact if they are not judging it fairly. If they're just saying, nope, wrong faith, we don't do it, we're not even going to give you the 1% roll of the dice. You find me a case that says the opposite, and I'll be impressed, particularly if it doesn't come in the Jim Crow era.
Your Honor, I would conclude with this. This court has stated that a fair process in and of itself is not an injury. It is the object of that process that must be the injury that's redressable. The object of this claimed unfair process is the approval of the planned unit development, rezoning, and development. And if that couldn't be approved for other reasons, just like the sign permits couldn't be approved in the Midwest case for other reasons, the unfairness and the unconstitutionality of the provisions and the process that are being challenged are of no consequence. And the injury, the object of the process, which is the approval, cannot be redressed. Fairness in the process is not an injury in and of itself. And this court has said that in the Wright v. O'Day case. That's quite an argument.
All right. Thank you so much, Mr. Sire. Get your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let's start with the last thing first, which is whether or not we're asking for the granting of rezoning. And the answer is no. We are asking the court to reverse Judge Morrison's decision where she found that we lacked standing. And we ask that hopefully on the merits, she's going to find that we're entitled to damages plus the ability to go back through the process. And as you said, have a fair process.
Let me ask this question. Is there anything forbidding you from going through both parts of the process right now?
Your Honor, there's a couple of things. One is a $26,000 filing fee that my client paid to go through the process in the first instance. And then also, when they filed it in the first instance, there were different standards that applied to the approval of final development plans under 1179-06. So you're saying
there's been a substantive change, not just this procedural change in the ordinance, but there's been a substantive change in the standards by which it's judged?
You got it. So 1179-06 was different before they did the amendment, and now has put in some bells and whistles related to the approval of the final development plan.
Counsel, I can't remember what you said about this in your brief. Are you in agreement that the declaratory equitable relief is now moot given the change in the commission, or do you think that's live?
The declaratory relief.
Injunctive relief. You've got declaratory injunctive, yeah. And the money damages are backward looking. So right. That's a standing inquiry, not a mootness inquiry, but the forward looking could have a mootness problem given the change in how the commission works and so forth. Are you agreeing that part of your claim is moot, or what's your theory as to why it's not?
And if I understand your question, Judge, the moving forward relief of declaratory relief related to the constitutionality of what now exists versus what did exist at when we filed the lawsuit?
Well, maybe this is the mistake in my question. I was assuming the constitutional claim, this delegation to private entities without discernible standards, that had been cured going forward. And the way you hesitated makes me now think you think that is still, it's still susceptible to your constitutional argument.
No, Your Honor, I think that they have cured that piece of it insofar as they have now made it a pure recommendation going from the PNC commission.
So that part of any injunctive relief, forward-looking injunctive
is moot.
That's correct. Okay, yes. I just want to make sure we're on the same page. All right.
We are. Thank you. And getting back to Judge Larson's question a few minutes ago to counsel, you had mentioned about the code actually applying to us, even though we weren't in Johnstown. And they did. They permitted us to apply. I'd have some disagreement with my colleague related to the sequencing and why this was done in such a way. I think there's testimony related to the fact that Johnstown wanted us to come in under a PUD versus having to come in as you normally would under an annexation. And they took our money and they went through the process and gave us the benefits of the process, held us to the obligations of the process, and then pulled the rug up under our feet when we got to that last constitutional deficient step. So council's already admitted they could have approved the plan regardless of the annexation. They clearly, if they thought us being outside of the jurisdiction had any bar, they wouldn't have accepted the rezoning application in the first instance. And frankly, the only bar to us, as we're talking about Judge Sutton's sign case, is only if Johnstown throws another barrier itself in our way. So there are no other barriers pre-existing that we have to deal with other than just moving through the boxes or the process and checking the boxes on what we're supposed to be doing. And I don't see the relevance of the ADA case, given the fact that that was somebody that's out prospecting ADA cases, not somebody who's generally applying to, that's a contiguous property owner to get into the actual jurisdiction. So for all these reasons, we would ask that the court reverse the decision and remand it back to the court. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ashrari. And thank you, Mr. Zeiger, for your helpful briefs and above all arguments. And really thank you for answering our questions, which we're always grateful for. It's an interesting case. I haven't seen anything quite like this before, I must admit. So thank you for all your excellent work on this. And the case will be submitted.